to a particular temperature. First of all, what they did when they magnetized it is they recognized that there's a whole lot of individual microscopic magnets in any magnetic material. Any ferromagnetic material has a whole bunch of individual microscopic magnets. And if it's the right kind of material that has the right coercivity, that really means stickiness, so to speak, of those individual microscopic magnets. If I got enough stickiness and I magnetize the whole material by putting it in a very strong magnet, I align all of those individual microscopic magnets, and because of their stickiness, that's my word for it, they stay in that orientation. And now all those individual microscopic magnets all add up in one direction, and you get this huge magnet. However, let me drop. Whenever I heat any material, I don't care if it's a liquid, a gas, or a solid, what the word temperature really means is how much average kinetic energy does each molecule have. And the majority of that kinetic energy is translational. In the case of a gas, those individual gas molecules in the air that's in your room right now are moving at the average speed of 500 meters per second. And if I took some of the air in your room and put it in a chamber and double the degrees Kelvin of that air, if the air right now is at 290 degrees Kelvin, and I raise it to 580 degrees Kelvin, instead of those air molecules moving at 500 meters per second, they'll be moving at square root of 2 times 500 meters per second. Maybe that's 790 meters per second. We can do that calculation, but I know exactly how much kinetic energy every one of those air molecules will have when I heat them up. Same thing happens with the solid material. In the case of the solid material, every one of those individual molecules are locked in position as if they were locked in position with a whole bunch of springs. Every individual molecule can move back and forth on its suspension springs. It stays approximately in the same location, but they wiggle back and forth on those springs. And if I heat up your solid material, they move more violently on those springs. The amount of deflection is greater. The average speed of moving back and forth on those springs of each individual molecule increases. So when I take your magnetic material and I heat it up to the Curie temperature, the individual molecules move so violently on those springs that all of a sudden...
repeater, timeout, cancel.
That all of a sudden that stickiness disappears, the coercivity disappears, the individual microscopic magnets start moving around randomly, and they're not all aligned anymore, and it loses essentially all of its magnetic field. So with most of the materials you and I are likely to touch, you heat them hot enough, they will lose their steady-state magnetic field they used to have. So does the magnetism itself have a temperature? No. But the materials that you and I use with magnetic experience do have some very strong temperature characteristics. Depending on what temperature that material is, determines how easy it is to magnetize and how easy it is for it to lose its magnetization. Maybe that helps a little bit. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2EO, Dick, I think you forgot about me.
Not yet. Go ahead, Wesley.
N2XJN. Okay, and also in number 5, we have visualization of magnetic flux. How would we be able to see the magnetic flux? And one of the ways is metal filings. The other one is a CRT screen of the old TV. Another one is the children tabloid from 50s and 60s. Then we have a ferrofluid, and if there is any other way to visualize. We may also skip that and get to our friend who is asking to take care of him, and then we cannot come back to the subject.
You guys go ahead. I didn't realize that there were 6 questions there. I forgot about that. Go ahead, Dick. You pick it up. I'm going to stand by. You guys do what you got to do, and I'll wait my turn at 2 EO.
Rich, why don't you give us a question right now?
All right, if you want me to, I will. I wanted to get a recommendation on, you know, I do this radio restoration, and I do the electronics, I do everything, including the cabinet painting, and I've been using these disposable airbrushes, so like $7 airbrushes. You throw them away when you get done. Thing is, I wanted to get a recommendation on something in the $50 to $100 price range. Anybody uses an airbrush to do these types of cabinets? I normally shoot, enamel, you know, mineral spirit-based paints. The reason I'm asking, my girlfriend wants to get me an airbrush for my birthday, and she's going to a hobby shop tomorrow in Florida. And she's been online, and she said there's all different types. Some use cartridges, some use compressors, and we're both very confused. I thought maybe I'd call her in the morning and give her a make and model number or something, if anybody knows. Into we go.
Mr. Nestle, not everybody else got the house.
Hey, you've got a fairly esoteric question there, Rich. There's one ham radio operator per 500 in the general population. And I'll bet you that only one ham per 500 hams do the level of restoration that you're doing. That makes you a creme de la creme there, Rich. Mr. Tashner, you're a rare bird. I'm going to ask, but I'll be amazed if we get an answer. Of all the experts out there who have ever done airbrushing or studied the issue, does anybody know who makes a good airbrush, what brand he should use, where he gets the best bang for the dollar? Is he likely to find it in his particular hobby shop in Florida and so on? Does anybody have any knowledge on airbrushes? Give us your call letters right now. KQRIW and the TechNet.
It's a J-E-White.
How about that? I never expected it. Go ahead, Mel.
Because actually not everybody else got the house.
Okay, well, I refinished a number of cabinets, and I got the most professional finish on a few of the cabinets. And how did I get it done? I went to a guy that, a body and fender collision place, and my brother happened to know one that, well, I don't know, you know, you sort of got to get friendly, I guess, because a little bit off their beaten path. But if you can get one of them to use their air gun, their spray guns, and give them the paint, they'll do anything with enamel or any of these new high-tech water-based paints. You'll never duplicate that finish. If you ever seen some of those cars, the way they've repainted, what they turn out, those are finishes, and you just cannot do what they what they're capable, because they're doing this all day long. So if you have somebody in the neighborhood, you could talk to him about it. I can say I could never have even envisioned finishes like that. Over.
If I understand you correctly, Mel, a body and fender place who does this day in and day out professionally with fancy kinds of enamels and lacquers and whatever can do a really good job. My guess is that your witnessing of the equipment that they use is probably very expensive stuff, a great big compressor and fancy paint guns. And my guess is that to purchase that level of equipment is probably not practical for a home user. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Definitely. Not only that, they have the preparation, right? Stuff to do the right preparation. And also, they got the spray booth. And the whole works, you know, they got the get-up there with the breathing apparatus. And like you say, very well filtered air and very good spray guns. And if you get a take a quart of that paint that you want, that's usually what goes into the spray gun, a quart at a time. And they put it into that, and with the right pressures, they know, and all that. Listen, like I say, it's their business. But I show you some of the panels they did, for my restoration or homebrew project and the cabinetry, I can honestly say better than original, Dick, over.
Now, when it comes to spraying air, spraying paint into the air, obviously it goes all over the place. These people are wearing fancy breathing apparatus to make sure that their lungs are not getting the paint. They're doing it against a very fancy wall that in some cases has an electrostatic attraction generator connected to that wall. In other words, the wall itself is charged with high voltage so that the individual paint particles that didn't go onto the subject that were sprayed into the air get sucked into that wall and stick to the wall by electrostatic attraction. I wonder if the guy running the paint shop described the way he makes that wall absorb the paint, and he's got a fancy exhaust fan besides. I wonder if you saw all that, Mel. Go ahead.
Dick, they got to process very little overspray. I thought it'd be all over the place. I looked in there, that's clean as all heck. They do some kind of, like you say, they do some kind of electrostatic charging of the item that you want sprayed, whether it be a car or a cabinet. They do have a system. Very little, I can almost say, literally nothing. If I was looking in that booth, I didn't know it was a spray booth, I would never suspect it, over.
Oh-ho. So in other words, they didn't electrostatically charge the wall to absorb the paint. They electrostatically charged the subject material so that any of the paint particles that almost missed the subject get sucked back to the subject by electrostatic attraction. And therefore, none of the paint gets wasted. Very sexy. Oh. Are you sure you want to get this heavy into this, Rich? The possibility exists that you only restore one cabinet per month. And if once per month you go to a good paint shop and you pay his price, maybe you'll get a lot for the money as opposed to trying to really own the equipment. Because the equipment that you're about to buy, I suspect, can only do a small fraction of the quality that this paint shop with their fancy equipment is capable of doing. You've got a difficult set of decisions here, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. Well, I beg to differ. I've done quite a number of Collins cabinets. I just did a cabinet to a Quake 22, and I got the paint perfectly matched. There's a paint store here that does it. I've been using these throwaway airbrushes. The problem with them is that occasionally you do a top or a bottom, you let it dry, you turn it over, you do it a side, then you turn it over, you do another side. It takes me about 3 afternoons to do it. But the problem is that sometimes it will spit and leave a bubble, and then I have to wait for it to dry and sand it and go over it again. So it's not as 100% consistent as I would like. What me and Geraldine were looking at were airbrush kits. They have different nozzles, different spray patterns. But she doesn't know what to buy, and I don't know what to buy. She's going to a hobby shop in her town in Homosassa tomorrow. So I just thought maybe somebody had some ideas. Let me go to reset.
Enthusiast.
Okay, Wesley recognized. I'll turn it back to you. I know it's a directed net, and you can pick Wesley up. Well, we did see, she saw it and I saw it, there's a line of airbrushes made by testers. They make, when we were kids, the glow fuel for the models and all that stuff, and they call it the Aztec line. I don't know if that's good or not, but they range from 70 to like $250. Some use compressors, some use canisters, that throw away canisters. I don't know what to buy, and I don't want to spend too much money. Let me turn it over to you, Dick. But I've done these cabinets with these $7 airbrushes, and except for having to redo them with the inconsistency, they've come out amazingly good. Back to net and pick up Wesley, M2EO.
I have a comment on that.
I turned it over to Dick, and then he'll turn it over to you. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, I've got a whole series of questions with you with reference to throwaway airbrushes, but Wesley first. Go ahead, Wesley.
And to exchange. GEMA, GEMA, volt static, PGC-1, electrostatic pine sprayer, is on the eBay right now, $899.99, but you can make an offer. As far as I know, this one is really good stuff. And all you need is just the rest of this, as there is only the box. So you might need the physical gun for that, and you would be able to do your electrostatic spraying. And to
since you're about to buy this thing in Florida, and since Daniel's in Florida, maybe he can give us some hints. KC2LYU, go ahead, Daniel. What do you think about the airbrush, the right way to go, K2LIW in the TechNet?
You can use a airbrush. And you can use a roller. A roller is a little bit better. You can good job. Now, you can't mix lacquer in with limon. It's going to break it up. So you're going to know how to do it. Now, and you spray a spray gun and lacquer, you got to know how much to put it in to the kilo, to the spray can. You got to count it, how much to put it in. And number one, you have to put hot now. You got to put a lot of stuff. But for reaching to pull it, use a roller brush, and it's easy, and it's simple, but you get a nice job. For the spray gun, it's a nice job. But someone is not going to do it. If not, you're going to get the bad lungs like me. I'm suffering right now with the bad lungs. I can't breathe. It's a pattern of heart attack right now where I have from a job for 23 years. Back to you.
So.
Yeah, it sounds like we've got to be careful here, Rich. Make sure that you're not breathing the fumes. When you talk about a throwaway airbrush, I presume there's some kind of a charged canister that supplies the pressurized material, and that's throwaway. I presume there are tips to the actual gun that are throwaway, where you sometimes get a sputter and a blob. I wonder if that's because of insufficient cleaning or if some of the previous material started drying a little bit. So is there a way of cleaning the tips after each spray incident? And what really is being thrown away? Is it just the tips of the spray gun itself? N2EO, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Dick, well, I found him in a local hardware store. He's the only guy I know that has them. Called Clearview Paint and Hardware on Francis Lewis Boulevard in Whitestone. It's made by a company, I never heard of them, it's called Proval, P-R-O-V-A-L. It's about $7 and change. They give you a bottle, and they give you, the whole thing gets thrown away. The gun itself, you fill the paint into the bottle, you screw it on, it has some type of compressed gas in there, and plastic nozzle. It's you know, for what it is, it's pretty good. I've gotten excellent results, but sometimes, like I say, I have to redo something. You can't change the spray width, the spray pattern. What you see is what you get. But, you know, $7-$8, that's what you get. But these people here, I bought them little cabinets, you know, like the size of a Collins cabinet. Let me But recently I brought them a cabinet to a Clegg 22, which is sort of like an off greenish gray, very unusual color. And he put it into a machine. He found you don't have to close the door on the machine to have it operate, so he sticks it in there and it tells him mix, you know, it's a computer algorithm. They all have these now. It tells them mix two parts of this, one part of that, three parts of this. And it came up with a very, very, I mean, really so close, you can't tell the difference. And I sprayed it. It came out very good. I usually first prime with, I prime with zinc chromate, and then I give it two or three coats. But it's an excellent job, but I guess I'm looking for for perfection, and I did want, I've done so many of these, I wanted to graduate to a, you know, an airbrush, something with, you know, that the hobbyists use on the model airplanes and things of that nature. Back to you, Dick.
Have you Googled the word airbrush and model airplane construction? The guys who are building these very elaborate electric models and gas-powered models, radio control models, some of them one-quarter scale, one-third scale, and whatever, some of these guys are getting a finish that really looks like it was done at a auto body shop, and I can't believe all these guys are going to an auto body shop. They've found a way of doing it. So the modelers have found a way of doing it, and by properly using the right search word, I think you're going to get a hold of those modelers, as I see it, Rich. What is throwaway? Is there a replaceable tip? Is there a replaceable bottle of charge material? Is there a replaceable bottle you put the paint in? Or does everything get thrown away and nothing is replaceable? Over to you, Rich.
In the ProVal, the whole thing gets thrown away. Everything. And they're cheap. You know, they for what they are, they're very good. But I want something where I can, you know, Jerry said she saw one advertised on the internet that had assortment of nozzles, you know, brass nozzles, I guess. I did Google. Were your idea checking out the model? The what I checked out, Dick, was hobby shops, and I see here in New York, and I checked the ones down where she is. I put in the hobby shop. Of Florida, and what I came up with was a number of companies. One of them I told to stay away from because they had three reviews and they were all bad. But she's going to one tomorrow called something Coast, Nature Coast Hobby in Homosassa, and he's got them from like $70 up to $250. And Neither of us can figure what the difference is, what I need, what's good, what I don't need.
Hotel Zulu Echo, KV2HZ with some info.
Okay, Hotel Zulu Echo. Now I'm hearing you through the machine. Before I wasn't. I don't think you had your PL turned on. Is it KC2HZE? And if so, it's Jacob in Port Washington. I'll go ahead with your information, sir.
All right, Dick, and the net, this is KB2, Hotel Zulu Echo in Frog's Neck. All right, I'm into remote control cars, gas cars, and all that stuff. The airbrush kits, the ones that start out at like $70, they could either run with a can of air, okay, and you could change different nozzles and needles. That's the thing with these. They do have the ones that have the mini compressors you could pick up for like $149. And you won't need to buy another piece of equipment except different heads for the spray pattern. You know, they come from copper, brass, it's all kinds of different things. I had the one that works on actually a can of air, and I didn't like it at all. The pattern after a while, you know, it messes up. So you want to get something decent, $100, $150 range with its own little compressor, you would be perfect. You could do a lot of stuff with that. Back to the net, KB2HZA. Over.
That sounds like good information, Tom. Let's see if Rich needs any fill on any of that. N2EO, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick, that's good information. I just, you know, I saw this company I just mentioned that she's going to tomorrow, Nature Coast Hobby in Homosassa. They're advertising. I'd like to ask HZE. Are you familiar with the Aztec line by Tester? They have a compressor kit. The list is 200. They got it for 169. The whole kit. Are you familiar with that, sir? And then turn it back to net control.
All right, let me pick it up. Definitely a pleasure to help you. I'm not familiar with that, but just remember, any air gun that actually runs off a compressor, you're going to be able to adjust the pattern and what have you, where with, like, some of these standard ones, you're not going to be able to adjust the pattern. You're going to just have to hold it different, you know, like 2 feet away, 3 feet away, whatever. But, you know, with a compressor, you're better off, and Testa's is very good in their airbrushing kits. I do know many people that do that. Every year I go to a convention up in Rockland, and they actually have, you know, a remote control cars, and you got to see some of the paint jobs these guys do. They actually sell the car bodies. Let me let this drop a second. They actually sell the car bodies for like $100, $175, some of them range, because that's how nice the artwork is. So anything with a compressor, I would go with. You know, just pay attention, watch your heads. They do come with solvent that you can clean the head. You know, after every use, that would be your best bet. This way, you know, the paint doesn't build up. And thank you for letting me come into the net, and definitely a pleasure to share. I hope it helps you out. Like I said, I'm not the best on it, but I did have one with a can of air, and that was a funny, funny experience. Back to you, over.
Yeah, Eric is recognized, but Tom, give us some more words about the Rockland convention that you go to. I think that's not the Ram Show that you're talking about. I think it's a different organization. The Ram Show is mostly model aircraft. I don't think they get into model cars as much. Tell us about the show in Rockland. Is it coming up? Should do you think Rich would gain something by going to it? And go ahead and tell us your funny story about the can, and then we're going to go over to Eric right after that. You got it first, Tom. Tom, go ahead.
All right, KB2HZD returning. All right, first of all, I haven't checked, but I think it should. I think it actually passed for this year. But there are other ones. The Cross County Convention Center, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, or the Westchester County Convention Center, they usually hold it every year as well. And it's real nice. You can actually pick up a lot of good deals on everything. You have all the big vendors, Kyosho, Team Associated, all the big airplane guys and what have you. You know, airbrushing is a real nice thing to get into. I'm going to let this drop, then I'll tell you the story with the can of air. Let me let this drop.
Mr. Wesley, not everybody else be going to hell.
Okay, now, when I bought my first airbrush kit, okay, it was a tester kit, all right, I paid $17 for it. What it comes with is the head of the gun, okay, it comes with a little glass bottle, and then it also comes with extra ones. Well, I bought a can of air, I hooked it up to the air, everything worked fine, I poured the paint in. After a while, like when you try and make, you know, the same mark over and over, it kept changing. I tried playing with the head a little bit, and sure enough, I made it like too wide, and I got shot with paint all over me. So, the ones with the can of air, it's not that much pressure. And with the compressor, you do have more of an adjustment. You know, this is just stuff that I've been with. I've been into remote control cars for like 20 years, just as long as the ham radio hobby. But definitely a pleasure to share, Dick. But you should find that out online for the conventions. They're unbelievable to go to.
And one quick question, Tom. Roughly what is the price of that compressor that you like using?
You can pick up a decent compressor for airbrushing around $100, $150. See, some people don't have the gun as well. You know what I'm saying? When they first start out, let's say he's a newcomer. He doesn't have a gun or nothing, and he comes across this type of kit. I would go with it, because even if you're not good with, you know, you don't like the heads that they give you, you know, as far as, you know, for the different adjustments or what have you, you just do your own, and you could buy your own. You know, you could use metal ones, aluminum. You know, there's all different things when it comes to airbrushing. It's a real big thing, believe it or not. All across the West Coast a lot, I hear about it.
Good to know. Eric, you got it?
Okay. Rich, what you want to do, if you want to look at the various the types of airbrushes that are out there, it's an easy one. We have a whole series of airbrush systems. Go to Pearl Paints in Manhattan. They have from the cheapest to the most expensive. And the folks there are very helpful, and they really know about that stuff. And they can take you through the various different models that are available, from the tiniest little pen airbrush to really large airbrushes that are used for doing mules and stuff like that. So you don't realize it, but you have a resource right nearby, and you ought to use it. And go to one of Manhattan downtown, because they have the largest selection of everything. K2RWK2J.
No, real quick for the net. Yeah, I've actually been to America's Hobby. In my area here in Throgs Neck, we have what's called Bruckner Hobbies, and they really, really grew very, very large. The store over here is humongous. They also have a store up in Westchester somewhere, and then one in Connecticut. So, you know, that's where I know most of my knowledge from going over here. I still got an RC-10 GT and what have you that I tried to airbrush with, like I said, that can of air. The can of air is garbage. You're better off with a compressor. And the heads, the different heads, there's a book from Testers, and it can actually tell you all different things. Like, let's say you want to spray thinner to one, you want to do a cabinet, you want to shellac it or whatever. They have heads just meant for that.
Good information, both of you guys. You need to fill in any of this, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet?
I have something for Rich.
Rich first. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, well, that's good information. Turn it over to Wesley. I appreciate what he said, and Eric said. That's really very good. All right, the compressor is obviously the way to go. Eric, I'm not going to pick it up here in New York. First of all, with the leg, it's hard. I can't get to Manhattan. It's my girlfriend in Florida is getting this as a birthday gift for me, and she's picking it up down in Homosassa, Florida. Or in that general area, she's 45 minutes away from Ocala. She's west of Orlando. She's north of Tampa. So she's getting it in that area. I think probably I'll tell her to go with this tester's kit with the compressor that we both looked at. But pick up Wesley. I want to thank everybody for the information. Let's see what Wesley has to say. Dick, back to you. K2RIW N2EO.
Welcome to
KC2QIQ.
Everybody else shut the hell up so Wesley can talk.
Wesley first, and then Greg in that area. Go ahead, Wesley.
Welcome to Wesley, not everybody else shut the hell up because Wesley needs to talk.
Okay, Rich, I have three compressors. I have one that I don't need, so contact me. And it's one of the things. Now, I have a question for both of you. The Hammerlund, if I probably pronounce that, the SP600, but with VLF at the end. That's the receiver that goes from 10 hertz to 540 kilohertz for extra, for a very low frequency. I wonder if Rich has any experience with that, and also if Dick or any other person on this net ever had experience with a very low frequency receiving antenna.
The Wesley not, the Wesley will go on and on and on and on and on. Bullshit.
Yeah, let's pick up Glenn first, who I just called Greg by mistake. And then we'll go back to the other two guys. KC2QIQ, go right ahead, Glenn.
You got it, Wesley.
Good evening, Dick, and good evening, everybody on the web. Just a comment for Rich. I do quite a bit of airbrushing on model RC cars, and the airbrush that I use is made from a kit. The name of the company that makes the compressor, the cables, the dryers, everything, the whole airbrush system. It cost me just under $200 with shipping, and it's made by a company called Master Airbrush, and I think they're a lot better. I started with those tester ones, and they weren't so great. But the Master Airbrush stuff is really, really good. It's just a matter of keeping it clean. And just one other hint for Rich, too. To keep the bubbles out, you have to have very, very clean, dry air. You need a good dryer between the compressor And most of these kits already have all of that built in, so that the air cables, the dryer, everything is all built in with the compressor and the airbrush. Back to you, Dick. KC2, QIQ.
Good information, Glenn. In case you need a fill, go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, no, I wrote that down, Master Airbrush. I will give that name to her tomorrow. Thank you.
KB2, yes, I also heard of Master Airbrush. I also heard of Master Airbrush myself. A lot of the guys use it to do their planes and what have you. A lot of aeronautical guys that like the plane part of the hobby, they do that. They use it might pay a little more. Don't forget. Plus, where you're buying it down in Florida, it would be cheaper than buying it somewhere here in New York. And I didn't mean to bust in, just want to share that with the net. I'm just glad I have something to offer. KB2HZ, I'll be on the side.
Glad you came in, Tom, and check in with us more often. Tom, am I correct that you live in the Bronx? Is that true, Tom?
C2QIQ with one more comment.
Yeah, definitely. I heard the other station. Yeah, I'm in Throg's Neck. I'm right across the water. I'm actually linked on Echolink right now, and I'm coming in on 2 meters with a new Yaesu 857D. Then I have some 10-meter questions I'd love to get to you, but there are people ahead. So I'll pass it back to Ned Dick, and this is Tom in the Bronx. So.
Good idea to use Echolink when you're so far away.
You've got it, Glenn.
Brilliant.
Yeah, just actually one more comment was that the hardest finish to get is gloss. You know, to get the matte finishes and some of the other finishes with paint are, they're easier because you can do them in multi-stage. But the problem with gloss and the reason you really need a good airbrush to do it is because you have to get the right ratio of air to paint without getting a drip or a run. And when you get that finally, that correct ratio on there, sometimes it takes a little bit of experimenting on cardboard or something first just to see how you can get that mixture, just to get that gloss to lay out. But just one other, thing I thought I'd mention inside there. Back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Daniel.
You need 3 guns. You need a gun for Brahma, you need a gun for the spray, you need a gun for the lacquer. Anyway, and you need something harder to put it in. And another one, I used to use a small spray gun. Now you need a meter also on a spray gun, a small meter to adjust the pressure, and now it's going to drift it down. And sometimes you have to buy a kit to change the kit, because it never lasts too long. Every time you finish the paint, you have to wash everything with the lacquer. It's a special lacquer to clean up the gun. And number one, if you want to make a good job, buy a small bottle. It's like the people using tattoo on a hand, and you can make a nice design on a finishes and everything. Back to you, KC2, about you, West Palm Beach. I know all the job, but my English is bad. Over.
We can understand you, Daniel. Not to worry. Need any fill on any of that, Rich?
I want to thank everybody very much. I've got some good information here, so I will make the phone call in the morning. Thank you very, very much, everybody. By the way, Dick, I'll turn it back to you. Maybe you can answer Wesley's question on VLF. I have no experience really below 80 or 160 meters, so I'm not sure of the model number or it went by me what Wesley was talking about. The model and make and model of that receiver, but it didn't ring a bell. So, Dick, back to you. K2RI up there. K2RIW, TechNet Weimar, and 2EO.
I think Glenn has done some low frequency work. Is that true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Yeah, Dick, actually, I have. It's interesting listening down there. It's a very, very challenging band to listen on because trying to find a signal between all that noise that's out there is a little bit of a challenge. But I've been able to basically make ferrite antennas, basically like winding things that look like, ferrite sticks with coils on the outside, and using my R7 receiver. The R7 receiver goes remarkably low in frequency, so you can listen way, way, way down there. But the antenna's a bit of a challenge. But there again, like the ferrite loop sticks seem to give me the best performance. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
Some people think that the lightning capital of the United States and maybe the lightning capital of the world is Gainesville, Florida. And when you were doing this low frequency work, I think you were not very many miles from Gainesville. So since lightning crashes makes life very difficult at super low frequencies, you were doing it in the most challenging place in the world. With those ferrite loop and other kinds of loop antennas, how low were you able to go in frequency and still hear signals, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
A few hundred kilohertz, I believe, Dick. I don't think I've ever heard anything down like... there's just so much noise at 100 kilohertz going all the way down. But there were some stations I was able to pick up in the... I think they were basically like beacons and things, but I didn't really hear any kind of like voice communication or anything down there. And some of it was kind of mysterious to determine whether they were just noise sources or, you know, real communication. But you can actually, you know, pick up some, I think they're beacons mainly. And that's what I was trying to really tune in down there. And my original experiment was to see if I could tune on to the beacons that are on specific frequencies that were documented. And then, you know, see if I could tune onto them and then check the frequency accuracy against my signal generators and the receivers and see if it all tracked together. And a few of them, I believe, were beacons, Dick, that I was able to get hold of. You know, they were basically just beeping tones that I could, you know, zero in on. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. And that was around, I believe it was around the 250 kilohertz area, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Information, Glenn. Thank you. I guess we'll go over to Wesley's next question. And that was, if I take a ground plane antenna and the normal radiator, I replace the wire of the radiator with a piece of coaxial cable and do not connect the shield of the coax cable to anything, what will happen? I don't know the answer to that. If it was a quarter wave ground plane, I know there would be some difference. If it was a half wave radiator, if the radiating wire was a half wave long, then the outer shield of the coax cable connected to nothing would get excited by the inner signal, and the signal on the outside of the coax cable would be almost identical to the signal on the inside. So it would just be a half wave radiator of a larger diameter. That's what would happen at half wave. But a quarter wave, it would be different. And I don't know. Does anybody have a prediction for what would happen with a quarter wave radiator where the antenna is working like a charm, you replace the quarter wave radiator with a piece of coax cable connecting only the center conductor and leave the shield thoroughly floating? The shield thoroughly floating would now be less than a resonant length. Therefore, very little signal would be on it. Therefore, I think the system would be partially shielded, but I'm not sure. Anybody got a guess? K2RIW in the TechNet?
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I've experimented with that before, Dick, and as long as that outer shield is not, that braid isn't touching anything, what actually happens is your original statement there that the antenna is a little bit shorter, it does happen because I've taken, you know, like you know, a rod and then tuned it with an analyzer, and you know, see where the dip is in the resonant frequency of the antenna, and, where it's closer to 50 ohms. And when I did it with just a piece of coax using the center leg to see what happens, generally it just is a little bit shorter, like somewhere around like 10% shorter than just say a regular you know, whip antenna. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
When you say it's shorter, you had to make it shorter to bring it back to resonance. Is that what you're saying, Glenn?
Just let the commercial go by. Yeah, that's exactly what I saw. Was that, in other words, the whips were like, you know, without, you know, just a standard whip would be roughly about 10% longer than, let's say, a piece of coax where you're just connecting the center lead. And it's just a little bit shorter. And also, I can't be 100% sure, and I'd have to run the experiment again, but what I also kind of noticed, it seemed to have a little bit broader bandwidth than just a whip by itself. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the broader bandwidth does comply with the Brown and Woodward curves. Those are those curves that you can find on the website amateurradio.tangovictor under K2RIW Feeding Yagis. There's a set of curves there for every reasonable length and every reasonable diameter of any kind of a monopole. There's a curve there telling you exactly what resistive component and what reactive component you're going to get. And as you make the diameter of the radiator larger in diameter, the bandwidth almost always increases significantly. That's a good way to go. And once you know that a dipole is just a pair of monopoles back to back, even though all of those curves are for a monopole on a great big ground plane, figuring out what's going to happen on a dipole is pretty easy just by doubling everything you see. So maybe that's part of the answer you're looking for. Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW. And by the way, is KC2WGB on frequency tonight? Over to you first, Wesley.
Wesley's gay boyfriend. Joseph, Wesley's gay boyfriend. Where are you, gay boyfriend?
N2XJN. Well, I have had a very interesting conversation with Eric, and I would love to have Eric to take a stand on it. Back to you.
Okay, Eric, if you're on frequency, what magic did you and Wesley discuss? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
We're discussing gay sex without the condoms.
Okay. Maybe Eric's not there and not available right now.
Okay. Here's the point. We started at first to talk about the coils and how the coils behave, whether they are concentrically placed or they are in parallel one next to the other. That was the first set of the questions. Then I was interested with the fact whether if we have a coaxial cable and we deliver the signal to the inner conductor and we don't grant the shield, and then we have a double shield, triple shield, how that would react. Now we switch to exactly the same configuration but with the whip of ground plane antenna. And the question then is, because I found based on discussion with Eric that, if I understood it properly, that shield would have no effect whatsoever, and if I put a copper pipe over that coaxial cable or a set of copper pipes, let's say 10 copper pipes, and all of them would be concentric placed, the antenna will still be able to radiate. Do you find that sufficient or insufficient as to exist?
As you start stacking more and more copper pipes that are ungrounded outside of that radiator, I know things are going to change. In theory, the copper pipes are going to be excited by the wire in the center successively. In other words, each copper pipe gets excited by the one that's on the inside of it. But as you start getting into very large diameter radiators, the Brown and Woodward curves will show you that the resistive component starts getting quite a bit smaller. The reactive component starts behaving in a peculiar way, and those curves will show that to you. So I know eventually there's going to be a difference as you start stacking copper pipes. I mean, just making the center conductor very large in diameter, having one simple semiconductor, is going to eventually make a change as that center conductor starts approaching a appreciable portion of a wavelength, like let's say 5 or 10% of a wavelength. Some funny things start happening. Eventually the reactive component starts behaving in the opposite direction, so to speak. And as I said, those curves will show it to you. I have done some experimenting on Yagi-like structures with super-wide parasitic elements and super-wide driven elements. And there's a lot of advantage to be gained in doing that. And one or two of the patents that I was involved in, it did do exactly that. There's a lot to be gained by it. It's a whole area that has not been properly investigated, simply because a whole lot of people have said to each other that that parasitic elements must be small in diameter so that they're high in Q, so that they don't create very much shielding. Good common sense. Not right. Not right at all. You can make the diameter of individual parasitic elements extremely large, and they still behave as parasitic elements. I know somebody who made a Yagi antenna by taking a whole bunch of CD-ROM discs and cutting them to the right diameter and stacking them onto a dowel, and made a Yagi antenna that worked very well. At first you would think that, and it's the so-called cigar antenna or the Simone antenna. At first you would think that each of those great big round discs are going to shield the parasitic elements that are behind them. The RF energy doesn't behave that way. It doesn't see it as a shield. So I think the difference happens slowly, but there will be a difference as you go to larger and larger diameters. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2IVX.
Go ahead, Len.
I've been listening to this conversation for a while, and I would make a suggestion. I just wonder if a few minutes spent on how the fields are oriented within a coax cable versus a twisted pair might be in order, because I think there may be something getting lost in this concept of a floating shield and what's going on with the shield. And then when you get to the concept of a piece of coax with a center conductor that's driven and the outer shield, I think one way of looking at it, or maybe it's a simplistic way of looking at it, is that if you look at the capacitance per foot or capacitance per inch, you'd probably find out that there's a relatively strong conductance, well, conductance is not the right word, a low reactance between the center lead and the outer, so that really it's just the outer conductor that's doing the radiating, because the center one, or I should say all the current that was flowing in the center one is now sort of bridged by the outer conductor. It's just a thought, but I just, when I hear some of the terms, it just sounds to me like this, the concept of where the fields are with the twisted pair versus a shield, grounded or ungrounded, or maybe not well understood. K2IVX.
I'm going to agree with what you're saying, Len. If the radiator is a half wave long, then the two tips have a impedance, a half-wave long piece of wire or a half-wave long piece of pipe. If you're feeding it at the end, the tips have an impedance of something like 1,500 ohms. So if the coaxial cable is a half-wave long physically, and you feed the center conductor, the 50-ohm impedance that exists between center conductor and shield at the end is a 50-ohm driving impedance to a 1,500-ohm impedance antenna. Obviously, the drive on the center conductor dominates, and essentially every bit of the voltage you put on the center conductor appears on the shield if it's a half-wave long. That's a beauty. So all you've done is found a fancy way of feeding a larger diameter radiator if it's a half-wave long. But if it's a quarter-wave long, life is very different. If I've got a quarter wave long antenna, quarter wave long dipole like thing without a center conductor, without a center insulator, quarter wave long piece of wire, parallel to the ground, high in the air, and I try feeding one end of it, that is a very non-resonant structure. To create any RF energy on that floating piece of quarter wave length long wire is extremely difficult. If I was feeding it from the center and I have a god-awful hair on his chest antenna tuner. I can feed it. But the impedance is extremely capacitive reactive when I feed it from the center. And if I feed it from one side, it doesn't get a hell of a lot better. So a quarter-wave resonator, quarter-wave radiator, is really non-resonant. So therefore...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So therefore, if I've got a quarter-wave ground plane where the quarter-wave monopole radiator becomes half-wave electronically because of the counterpoise, the great big sheet of metal, and the mirror image of the other half of the monopole in that sheet of metal. It electronically is a half-wave long, a quarter-wave radiator on a great big sheet of metal. But the outer shield of the coax cable floating is not a half-wave long. It's only a quarter-wave long, and it's fully floating. And almost no voltage will appear on it. So now you have a 90% shielded structure, is my first guess. If you've got a quarter-wave radiator, center conductor, ground plane, and a floating outer shield of that coax cable. Do you see where I'm going on that one, Glenn? Len? N2IBX? K2IBX? K2RYW?
Well, yes and no, and maybe the problem is that I'm not seeing the effect of the transformer, quarter-wave transformer that you're seeing. I just tend to look at it in a situation like that. I don't know what the capacitance per foot is, or capacitance per inch, but if the reactance between the center conductor and the outer shield was low enough, then the outer shield is going to conduct just like the inner shield would, or I should say it's that the current that would normally be flowing along the center conductor is now going to flow on the outer conductor. And that's why Glenn saw what he saw. I don't remember what he said with what length was, but it just looks like, as you said, for the half-wave case. I just don't see it being different for the quarter-wave case because the ends of the shields are not grounded and they're not touched. I should say that's why it seems to me like it's the same thing, and I look at it as lump constants. But maybe that's not a valid way of looking at it. But okay, I appreciate your taking the input, Dick. K2RIW, K2IVX.
KC2QIQ.
You got it, Glenn.
I think the reason that the quarter wave coax where the shield is not terminated, it's just floating, still works is because, I mean, think of it this way. If the shield were connected all the way through, it would be the same, you know, it's to the center leader. It was shorted on both the top and on the bottom. It's basically the same thing as a whip again, because, you know, there's no difference between the electrical difference between the shield and the center conductor. But if they're not connected, there's no real difference in currents between those two things, because there's nothing completing the circuit on the shield. So the shield is basically just kind of like... you know, floating along at a high impedance next to the center conductor, if you know what I'm saying, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I know that was a miserable description, though. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, when you look at the Brown and Woodward curve and you realize that a quarter-wave-long piece of coax cable floating in air is a kind of a dipole where the left side and the right side is an eighth wave monopole, and you've got a pair of eighth wave monopoles back to back. The Brown and Woodward curve tells me that an eighth wave long monopole, which is 45 degrees long, has a resistive component of impedance of about 5 ohms. So a quarter wave long floating dipole, this was really a pair of eighth-wave monopoles back-to-back, has about 3 or 5 ohms of impedance on each monopole. I'll give you 6 or 10 ohms impedance total, and you're driving that center conductor. That coupling is going to be fairly poor. That's a partial shield. Now, because it's a partial shield, that means that the center conductor radiator doesn't get a chance to radiate very well. As such, if the signal can't radiate, And if you've got a good antenna tuner, the signal's going to get stronger and stronger. It's going to build up to a high impedance until it finally does radiate. So I think you're going to see a great big chunk in a change in impedance in order to get the radiation. But until we really do the experiment, we're not sure. I'm speculating. You see where I'm going in this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I'm following you on that.